Judy Carmichael's Jazz Inspired is produced in association with Jazz Times. Pianist songwriter Steve Million grew up in a small town in Missouri with the fetching name of Boonville. Looking back now, Steve appreciates the quiet of that environment and the opportunity for freedom. But in his younger years, he couldn't wait to move on and pursue a life in jazz, a musical passion that started at the tender age of 7 when his mother took him to a Count Basie concert. Now based in Chicago, Steve Million keeps a busy performance and teaching schedule and celebrates one of his favorite musicians, Thelonious Monk, in a two-keyboard band with Jeremy Kahn called Double Monk. His latest collaboration is his CD Jazz Words with vocalist Sarah Marie Young, for which Steve wrote the music and lyrics. I talked to Steve about it all from his home in Chicago. I'm Judy Carmichael, and this is Jazz Inspired. I love that your first inspiration to get you into jazz was Count Basie. That's personal because the first record that I heard, the first jazz record recording that I heard that made me want to be a jazz musician was Count Basie. So we share that, and I think what I really loved about that story is that he was smiling at you and then introduced you to the band and how important those things are. And I say that for other jazz musicians to hear it, that personal connection. So talk about that. It's such a sweet story.
Well, you know, I think I was 7 years old. So that would make it 1961, 62, something like that. 7 or 8. I was a little kid. I had my little sport coat and my red dickie. My mom always put my red dickie on, you know. And so, and she said, you have to go. And we had a military school. We have a military school in Boonville called Kemper Military School. And they had a ball every year. And usually it was just a band from Columbia, Missouri or somewhere, St. Louis or something. But this year, somehow they booked the Count Basie Orchestra to play their dance, you know, their ball for the spring ball, right? So my mom, who was always all about culture, said, you have to go. We have to go hear Count Basie. And even though, you know, there's probably going to be no kids there, I'm going to take you, you know. So my mom and dad took me to this event. And it was basically a beautiful ballroom with the Count Basie Orchestra, who were on the road traveling across. I guess that at that time, I don't know really what the deal was, why they were playing this gig, but it was great. So, you know, there really wasn't any place for me to hang out. So I'm just on I'm just on the edge of the stage, kind of like, you know, watching Count Basie, looking up at him, you know, and he kept looking at me while he's playing, looking over at me, smiling. And then the break came and he comes right over to me. He just comes right over to me and says, "Hey, do you want to meet the band?"
That's so great.
He grabbed my hand and then he took me backstage and introduced me to everybody. And then he said, "Hey, why don't you take me out and we'll walk around and you can introduce me to your parents and to all the people." And so the whole break, I was hand in hand with Count Basie, right? And he says, "Lead me around." And then after we did all that, then he goes, "You want to sit on the piano bench with me when I play the next set?"
Oh, my word.
And I said, "Well, yeah." And at this point, I think I was probably, we had a piano and I was probably playing a little bit. I was mostly interested in riding my bike. I really wasn't all that consumed with it, but.
You were 7. I want to point this out.
Yeah,
you were
I was 7. Yeah, I was just a kid, right? So, and this was, you know, it was probably, you know, well past my bedtime at any rate. But, you know, I sat on the piano I really don't remember much except sitting there and taking it all in. But I do think that moment is the moment that, you know, ignited something in me to want, you know, I thought, how cool is this? This is the coolest thing ever.
I'm thinking you were inside of that band.
Right.
Think of how rare that is. I mean, most people obviously will never have that experience. Even, I'm a jazz pianist. I've never played with a big band. You know what I mean? You were sitting right there in the Basie band.
Right.
So that's beautiful.
It was quite a and I probably met Freddie Green, right? I mean, he was probably there. I don't remember specifically anybody, but it was just, I remember Basie, and I remember the look and the incredible warmth. And then years later, I saw that if you look at that, the Great Day in Harlem photograph, the famous Life magazine, or it was Look magazine, I don't know, the famous photograph of all the jazz musicians. If you look at where Basie is in that photo, he is sitting on the curb with the little kids, and he's laughing and talking to the little kids. He has no interest in the musicians. He's down there with the kids sitting on the curb, and he's talking. He's going, eh, he's like talking to them. So I remember seeing that. I about cried when I saw that, because I thought that's the way he was with me. He was like, he was interested in me as a person, And because I was different from all the, he realized that here's an innocent soul. I'm going to take him in, right? It was very nice.
Basie band toured constantly back then, and for him to take that time and not say, no, I'm going to go have my break, I'm going to be on my own, he took the time to introduce you and reach out and let you know that this music was inclusive, not to make too big of a deal of it, but I think it is a big deal. I think that's really sweet.
Years later, I used to play at this club in Kansas City called Milton's Tap Room, and I played there pretty regularly, all the jazz musicians did. And Milton Morris was a guy who ran a lot of clubs during the time when Kansas City was a big deal, right? He ran a lot of clubs, and he knew Count Basie quite well. He knew, he knew Art Tatum. He knew, all these people that came through. He knew Charlie Parker quite well. He knew Jay McShann really well. So coming up in Kansas City and becoming a professional musician there, I'm playing at Milton's little club on Main Street, and one night I'm playing there, and Basie walks in and sits at the bar, right? This is in the 70s, or late 70s, I think, or maybe early 80s. Could have been the early 80s. But Basie walks in, just sits at the bar, and I go on break, and I went over and I said, oh, Mr. Basie, hello, do you remember meeting a little boy? I brought the whole story up to him.
Oh, you did? So you got the chance to say
it to him. Yeah, I did bring it up, and he said, oh, yeah, I remember. I don't think he really did. Honestly, I don't really think but he was really gracious, and he said, oh, yeah, I remember you. Sure. Do you remember, I don't even know if you remember where Boonville, Missouri was, frankly. I mean,
but the fact that you got to tell him what that meant to you,
that's the important part, and
that you're now a professional pianist at this point.
I said, the reason I'm doing this is because all those years ago, you were really nice.
Well, and that's that means so much. Yeah. And you brought me a great blues. I love having people bring me all this music. The best part of this show is that I get introduced to all this great music.
Right.
And your Otis Spann. Talk about this track. It is so great. And you say you play it for students, too, talking about the great blues feel. So talk about that.
Well, you know, I was looking, you know, when you gave me to come up with five tracks, like I said, I probably would come up with five different ones. But I think this one would always be on the list because this particular tune, I remember the day I bought that record. In Boonville, we had a drugstore, and that's where I bought all my records. They had a little, you know, a couple of bins full of records, right? I bought my Beatles records and Rolling Stones records and all, you know, everything else. But, I got really into the blues, and I was really into the English blues stuff with Eric Clapton and all that kind of stuff. But I also was really into Chicago blues, and I remember I had Muddy Waters records, and I remember the piano player in particular on the Muddy Waters records was Otis Spann. And then one day I'm in there at the record store, and I see there's an Otis Spann record, and it's on Folk Archive Records. And I bought it and I went home and the very first track is Good Morning, Mr. Blues. And I just remember thinking, and at that time I was playing blues piano that I was really into. I had taught myself from listening to those records, how to play the blues scale and how to play dominant seventh chords and how to play bass. I could play boogie woogie bass lines and do that, goon, 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 you know, and keep a groove. And I also played harmonica. I was really into it. You know, I loved it. But when I heard that track, that Good Morning, Mr. Blues, I just remember feeling, still to this day, when I listen to it, I get this feeling of that this really brings you into the world of the blues. And the blues is not about the notes you play. It's not about a technical achievement at all. It's about a feeling, and it's a feeling that is so difficult to. I can't teach that, but I do try.
Oh, you anticipated me because I was going to ask you how you teach it. So you can't teach it.
Well, you know, I think all I can do is bring students to it because a lot of my students, you know, I mean, today, last couple months, I teach an improv class at this dedicated music school here called Merritt School of Music. And I asked the student, our entire semester, this last semester was devoted to blues. And we did Kansas City blues, Chicago blues, New Orleans. We focused on this. I did Memphis, a little bit about Detroit, but mostly on the blues origins. And I remember, and these are kids from Chicago, and I asked them, do you know who Muddy Waters is? And they didn't know.
Oh,
none of
man.
Them had ever heard of Muddy Waters. So,
wow.
You know, this is what, I mean, I just have to bring them into it first.
Interesting.
I might be able to teach them something about it later, you know. I can teach my piano students certainly how to play blues. That's one of the things we study. But there's so much of a difference between bebop blues and post-bop blues and stride piano blues. I mean, there's just so many. I mean, blues is just basically the undercurrent of the entire world of jazz, really.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, it's
mm-hmm.
where it all started.
Mm-hmm.
So
mm-hmm.
we got into that. I mean, at any rate, but that track was the one that really, it still stays with me. I still play it every year for students, and I say, let's listen to, you know, and, you know, and, you know, I don't think back in the days when I listened to it, I even knew it was in the key of D, which is not the easiest key to play blues
no,
in. You know,
no, like, and you don't expect it. Blues in D.
Right. And I've listened to a lot of Otis since then, and he plays in all kinds of keys, and he really has a really beautiful flowing sound in any key. It's amazing. You know? But, you know, I've often tried to play exactly like what he's playing, and I just can't quite, you know, it's like one of those things of, it's in his DNA, that sound, you know, it's not like something that I can specifically, like I can copy a Charlie Parker solo, I can copy a Bud Powell solo, I can sort of, you can't play anything just like somebody else, obviously, but that particular Otis Spann is just so kind of in the cracks rhythmically. And he played piano with all these great singers as well, Muddy Waters and others, many others included. But the fact that he himself could sing that well, and he never was known, you know, really as a singer. He was known as a piano player.
Good morning, Mr. Blue. Blues, how do you do? Good morning, Mr. Blue. Mr. Blues, how do you do? No, I feels all right now, but I come home to worry you. You know I feel so low, till I don't know what to do. You know I feel so low, till I don't know what to do. You know I'm so glad you came home. You know that I'm in love with you.
I'm Judy Carmichael, and this is Jazz Inspired. My guest is pianist-composer Steve Million. You brought a track that that you're making me think of now, because I'm thinking of bringing your students to learn blues, and we know how much you have to listen over and over and over again to get this feel and try to play, maybe playing like it, but you're not going to play just like it, all of that. This Monk track is mind-blowing.
Did you listen to it?
Oh, my God, the whole thing.
And it's 28 minutes.
No, well, I put it on, and I was kind of wandering around and doing some things and listening to it, but then it kept going on and on and on, and then I went in and checked in on how long it was. I thought, well, obviously, I need to just sit here and listen to this. And I think that a lot of times, and maybe people are hipper than I think they are, but I think that a lot of times people don't realize the work, the real work it takes to be a great artist, and the concentration and the working it out and the mistakes that are made. And this track is such an epitome of what it takes. Mm-hmm. This is such a gift you gave me, because I wasn't even aware that this existed. So talk about this mind-blowing track.
Well, one of my good friends, one of my dear friends, when I moved to Kansas City, I started playing music with a guy named Steve Cardenas, who's a great guitarist. He now lives in New York, and he's, you know, done really well. But he's also the transcriptionist for the Thelonious Monk fake book. He did all the transcriptions for that book. And even when he was doing it, he would send some of them my way, and he said, do you think this is a B flat or an A, or what do you think? You know, like we were Monk enthusiasts when we worked together in the 70s and 80s in Kansas City. We've both gone our different ways. We've gotten back together recently and done a record together. But at any rate, Steve, I was talking about, you know, something about a Monk tune. I don't remember. He goes, man, you should check out this record called Monk the Transformer. He goes, it's hard to find. And he goes, I got a copy, but I had to buy it on eBay. And that's where I bought my copy on eBay. But I got it. And he goes, what it is one, it's one tune. It's I'm Getting Sentimental Over You for like an hour and a half. That's one of the tracks. I sent you the longest one, right? There's the first one's 4 minutes, the next one's 6 minutes, there's one that's 12 minutes, and there's 28 minutes, and there's an 8 minute, you know, like, and it's just all him going over and over, and then him practicing the whole tone riff that he's, you know, trying to get it just right so it flows and he comes out right on the beat and all. I mean, he just plays it over and over. There's parts where he's just isolating passages and playing them over and over again. That particular track that I sent you is mostly him just playing the song over and over again. But he does change tempos. He double times it. He starts out real slow and then he double times it. And then he, you know, it's really interesting. He's trying to come up with, while he's doing that, I'm thinking he's really internalizing everything about his way of playing the tune. For one thing, usually people play that tune in F. I think the standard key is F. Usually when a horn player calls it on me, it's usually an F. But I've always played it in E flat. In fact, for years, I recorded on my very first record. I did an arrangement based on those changes from a solo piano version that's on one of Monk's solo piano records. I believe it's the one where he's sitting in a wagon, a little red wagon. He's sitting. I think it's that one, Monk himself. I think it's called. But anyway, so I'd always been into that, the way he played that tune. And then, he recorded it a lot with his quartet, and, you know, it's one of his favorite tunes to play. But the thing about that is, you know, my students will come in, you know, and they'll say, they'll play some song, and, you know, I can, you know, maybe the first two measures are pretty good, but the rest of it's sort of falling apart. And I said, well, how many, did you practice this? I mean, you know, yeah, I tried it a couple of times. I mean, they've had like a week, right? And that's not going to do. I mean, so I'll say, you need to check this out. And I do.
No, absolutely.
And these are serious. My students that come to me are fairly serious, you know. And if they seem to be lagging in, you know, the other day I had a student come in who's doing, you know, stuff to get into college. And he played the wrong melody note on I'm Getting Sentimental Over You. And he'd already sent it in. I said, why didn't you run that by me? I mean, you know, that melody note, you play it the same every time. And that's incorrect. And he goes, you think they're going to get me on that? I go, well, if I was judging, I probably would say,
it's the wrong melody.
It's the wrong note. I mean, you know, and nobody, and he goes, well, I copied the Sonny Rollins version. So we put on the Sonny Rollins version and it's an F natural, not an F sharp. And I said, look, you know, you just misheard it. You've got to really get into this. And I said, and then I played him this Monk thing because I said, listen how many times Monk plays this tune. Have you ever sat down and played a tune for 28 minutes? I mean, ever in your life? He goes, no. And I go, well, just think about that. Just think. The other day, I just put that on and just played along with that entire track.
Wow.
With just my left hand because I wanted to. And I noticed Monk does almost exactly the same thing every time over with his left hand. And every now and then he varies it.
Thank you.
The other thing I tell people who study Monk is that everything Monk did, everything Monk wrote, is basically comes from a stride piano perspective. Mm. Even his most outlandish, weirdest tunes, they're, you know, you can play Trinkle Tinkle like a stride piano.
Yeah.
You can play almost any of his tunes, you can just go, you can play, you know, stride piano underneath it. That's where he came from. That was his angle. So he likes tunes that have sort of a cyclical feel, and can, you know, you can really, you know, like his reharmonization of, I'm going off tangent right now, but his
reharmonization. No, but I love it. It's fascinating.
His reharmonization of T for two, for instance, which is, you know, instead of like in A flat, you know, it's 2-5, 2-5, 1-4, 3-6, you know, that kind of thing. Mm-hmm. But he's got it starting on D7 and cycling all the way D, G's, you know, like, right? C, F, B flat, A flat, G, G flat, F, B flat, A flat. And that's how he thinks in that way, you know?
Yeah.
If you play that, get used to it, that's really fun. And those are the same, basically the same chord changes to the tune Skippy, which he wrote a long, long time ago, which he does a lot faster, which was just this incredibly difficult bebop head over those same changes. Mm. So he wrote the changes. He reharmonized T for two, and then he wrote another tune on that. And then he came back, and then he recorded T for two. It's so amazing to me.
It's interesting, as you're saying this, you're reminding me, because years ago, Roy Eldridge told me, not Roy Eldridge, Dick Wellstead told me that the piano player said that when he would play with Roy Eldridge, Roy would always want him to stride behind him. And Dick would feel that stride wasn't appropriate. But that's what Roy heard. That's what Roy came up with. So no matter what harmonically was going on with Roy when he was playing, he was hearing stride as an underpinning for it, which is what you're talking about with Monk, which is very interesting because it's what they came out of.
The more I play, you know, professionally, the more I find myself, you know, like especially on I have this gig with the bass player and we, you know, don't have drums. And I find myself a lot of times, even like when the bass player is soloing, I'll go into a real light, really soft, but stride ideas, you know, because it works. It keeps the beat and it changes up the feel from just playing changes. You know, like I'm basically a modern jazz pianist, but through Monk, I've learned how to go, you know, I kind of got back into going back in the past. One of the other cuts that I didn't send that I was almost in the top 10 was that trio record with Buddy Rich and Nat King Cole and Lester Young. You know, you're probably hip to that.
Of course.
Yeah, I mean, it's like
my favorite. I give it to everybody because you don't even realize there's no bass player. Plus he isn't striding. And that's what's so interesting. He's he knows exactly, we're talking about Nat Cole, knowing exactly what bass note to play or just doing like a brum. And then you hear that like on I Found a New Baby or one of those. And you think, wait a minute, there's no bass player. And wait a minute, he's not striding in a traditional sense. And yet what you're hearing is a complete, almost quintet.
Yeah, it's a, like a crossover record too, because it isn't, you're right, it isn't stride, but it has, because I think that the story is that the bass player just didn't show up or something. There was supposed.
Oh, is that true?
I didn't know that. I'm not sure. I always wonder if that, I mean, I don't know. Somebody told me that, and I don't know if it, you know, honestly, I don't know if it's true, but it does feel like, yeah, let's just go ahead and do it with the three. I mean, I don't know if this was planned, but it does have a very holistic feel to it.
And I
love the way the trading between the drums and the piano and the sax is just amazing. The depth of feel and some of the rhythmic things that Nat's doing. I mean, it's just like, I listen to that record over and over again. And of course, that's a Bible record for many people. And that's a record that I just kind of recently discovered. So,
it is. You know, well, it's a Bible record for me, definitely. I'm Judy Carmichael, and this is Jazz Inspired. I'm Judy Carmichael, and this is Jazz Inspired. Our show is made possible in part with generous support from Steinway & Sons. Additional support is provided by Jazz Times Magazine, providing entertaining and provocative coverage of the jazz scene since 1970. On the web at jazztimes.com. For a schedule of upcoming programs, visit our website at jazzinspired.com. You can listen to Jazz Inspired on your favorite podcast platform and email us at info@jazzinspired.com or visit us on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram at Stride Queen. Although we broadcast on NPR stations, we're an independent production not funded by NPR. Please visit jazzinspired.com to find out how you can chip in and support us. No gift is too small. And please write a review on Apple Podcasts, which is the best way for us to entice others to listen to the show. Thanks for helping us spread the word and celebrate our 22 years on air. I'm talking with pianist-composer Steve Million about his CD, Jazz Words, with Sarah Marie Young. We'll talk about your wonderful CD. I'm just swept away by it and doing the lyrics as well. I want to, well, all of them, but I want to jump in on Nika's Changes. Yeah. Because now you may think this is crazy,
yeah,
but the use of language and the rhythmic use of lyrics in this reminded me of great rapping, rap music, when, you know, when the words really work, when it's, I don't know how else to say it, it reminded me of that. It was really lovely and not something that I think about with contemporary lyric writing a lot. And I was really taken with this track. Talk about it.
Yeah, it's interesting that no one else has asked me about, I've done a couple of interviews about this record and no one's asked me about this particular track. For one thing, it's in 5/4 time, so writing the lyrics was tricky because of the meter and the melody. I was thinking of it sort of as a samba in five. That's mm-hmm. kind of was my angle as far as the bass. That's what I told the drummer. I said, just think just a solid groove. I don't want it to go, you know, like, you know, I don't want it to be... you know, corny or, you know, or not corny. I love that. I love those.
No,
things.
But I know what you mean. And I think I want to jump in because one of the things that impressed me was that it sounded so natural. And we know that what you just did with the Dave Brubeck things, he made Five sound natural.
Yeah,
and right. What impressed me so much about this track, I mean, I love the lyrics and the music, but that it worked so naturally in this unusual way without making you think, oh, I'm being really clever. I'm going to write around this 5/4. And that's why I say the rap, because I think great rap, the best rap music, or best rap, I don't even, do they call it rap music? But you know what I mean. I'm thinking of
hip-hop.
Hip-hop, I think of listening to Hamilton and how he wove all those different styles together and made it work. And that's what this really reminded me of.
Well, one of the things that makes that whole record work is Sarah's ability to deliver a lyric in a complex setting where it's very clear. And that's
absolutely
one of the things that the Hamilton, I went to see Hamilton and I was impressed with how the story was told. I mean, to me, that was the best use of hip hop language I had ever seen.
Absolutely. I agree.
Because stories are always told well if people can understand what's being said. And that I was just the diction and ability to bring the lyrics across. And one of the things I've worked with Sarah for years on various other projects too. But, you know, when she agreed to, you know, we got together for a year on that project twice a month for a year. I mean, it was a large commitment. Of course, she didn't have two kids. She has two kids now, but at that time she was single and she would come over and we would work on this stuff. And we worked really hard on that. And I think that tune was one of the more difficult ones for her to, and like you talk about a tune that I had to play over and over again. I just had to sit and play that kind of like the way Monk would play that. Just to get it to where I felt natural. I mean, I would put my metronome on, clicking on, you know, with the strong beat on 5, just so I could make sure I would never goof this tune up. And I could play sort of across the bar lines. I could do things and be natural on it. So I did a lot of work. I did a lot of homework myself. Now, the lyrics, I mean, I came up with the melody, obviously, well before I wrote this tune as an instrumental. Most of these tunes were instrumentals before I put lyrics to them. But I wrote that instrumental, and I really never, ever thought I would write lyrics to it. It didn't seem like that kind of a tune. It seemed more like a modern jazz, you know, 5/4 thing, right? But then these lyrics came to me. I was practicing it one day, and these lyrics came to me, and they're about my daughter, Nika. I just, you know, ran them across, you know, Sarah, and she just ate it up, man. She just, I don't know exactly anything other than that's when I do a live gig now where we're playing that stuff, that's the one tune I have to make sure I start a week before and just start practicing.
I'm not surprised.
Because, you know, it's a long form and it's got a lot of different changes and it goes through a lot of development, you know, and you just have to be spot on with it. You can't have any second guessing, and you know.
And she does make it sound very natural. She has also a really lovely. There's something about her timbre that, for me, has so much. I don't want to emotions too broad. Has joy and passion, but also has the angst in there. There's that melancholy. I mean, it really comes through, but it's also her delivery, because it seems every singer these days has loads of technique.
Yeah.
But she also brings that other element to it, which is really wonderful. And especially on a song like this that, as you say, it's tough.
I see those changes every day. Sometimes I close my eyes and pray I can help you understand. You'll need a plan, I'll lend a hand. I'll help you play with the band. Trust me, we're all on this beach, toes in the same sand. The rain falls down.
that tune was very near and dear and special to my heart, and you're the first person who's asked me anything about it. I mean, well, mostly they want to ask me about the Heaven's Munkatroyd, which is...
Well, I loved it all, but I think this may be my favorite track. Oh. I kept coming back to it. So that's I'm glad nice. I got to talk to you about it because I thought it was wonderful. Talk about Hymnal. That was another one that really touched me.
Yeah, Hymnal, I wrote that music. Originally, I wrote the music in the key of C. No, I wrote it in the key of G originally. That's right. And I was playing it. I wrote it right after 9/11. And it always was called Hymnal. And I didn't have any lyrics. And I thought when I wrote it, I remember thinking, you know, I had that bell-like... you know, the thing at the beginning and at the end, which is actually really hard to play. I must say that I don't know why I made such, that part sounds kind of easy, but if you play that part, that's actually one of the hardest things that I play on that whole record. And I continually screwed it up. I mean, I kept trying to, can we just take another pass? I kept screwing it up when we recorded it, and I screw it up sometimes a lot. I don't know what it is about that particular part, but I have.
Well, and once you get it in your head, I've had that. Once I fall off a cliff with something, then every time I play
and
it,
that's
then I'm
what
like,
Sarah says. Yeah. Sarah goes, "You just got a mental block because it's nothing. That's not harder than anything else you play." But I think it is. I don't know why. I just think. So at any rate, but that little part.
I hear you, brother. I've done things like this,
right.
So I.
That little part, though, was kind of where that tune started. I created that little part, right? Mm-hmm. And then the tune flowed out of that. Actually, Sarah made up a lyric in that tune. Mostly I had written all the verses, but on the chorus, I couldn't think of the second line of the chorus. And she came up with, "These will not be sorrowful seeds we sow." And that just seemed to be like, wow, that works just perfectly with the line. So we used that. And other than that, I pretty much wrote all those lyrics. But, you know, that's the nice thing about collaborating with somebody who's just so... it kind of gets immersed in the project because she could actually make these suggestions or suggest a harmony or do these things that I would never have thought of. You know, she's really a great collaborator.
Just because this is such a favorite of mine, talk about Elise Regina and Jobim, any chance to play any of their things I love. So, and it's so specific because I asked for 5 tracks. Mm. So I'm always curious what people are going to bring. So talk about this track.
Well, the track I selected is Brigas Nunca Mais, I think it means sad no more. I believe that's what the title means. But it's such a happy little cut with, to me, it's like the perfect expression of bossa nova. It just has that lightness and beauty to it that, and it's only a minute, was it a minute 41
seconds? Really short.
Right, it's a short little track. And I've always talked with my friends, I've been into that record ever since I could get a copy of, you know, because it didn't come out in America for quite a long time. And when it did come out, you know, everybody wanted it. And it just is one of those records that just is kind of, if you're into Brazilian music, and especially Tom Jobim, you know, that's like one of the great collaborations in that world. I mean, he's done so many great recordings, there's no doubt about it. But that one is really special. And I've done a lot of reading and research about that record, which is really interesting because it really was kind of thrown together. They didn't.
Oh, really?
You would think that when you hear it with all the strings and the production, it seems so like they had thought about that. No, they just said, hey, you know, Elise said, hey, I want to make a record with you. Yeah, we'll fly up here to California, you know, LA, and we'll meet up. And she shows up with her husband, Cesar, and they, you know, and then and Jobim says, well, we'll just book, you know, we'll book a studio. I'll get, we'll hire LA Sidemen. It'll be great. And Cesar goes, no, I'm bringing in my group. You know, he wanted to bring Brazilian players. And Jobim and him argued about it. There was all this arguing and fighting, evidently. And Cesar just kind of took over. He said, no, this is, we're going to do a real Brazilian record.
So, oh, wow.
And Jobim, they actually, during the final run of recording and producing the record, they had to ask Jobim to stay at home. He was too nitpicky and too worried about all these other things. And it was, Cesar said, I can't deal with it. You have to just stay home, please.
Wow. Oh, yeah, I had no idea.
It's in Cesar's I think he has a biography, but it's only in Portuguese. And a friend of mine told me, he sent me basically his cliff notes of this because I wanted to talk about it because I've done this record several times. What I did essentially for your viewers, listeners, I transcribed the whole record and we did it. There's a place here where you can do you select a record that you want to do and you do it. And a lot of times people select something that's a simpler to do than, you know, something like this. But mm-hmm, me and Sarah, mm-hmm, I talked it over with her. I said, what do you want to do? And she goes, Elise and Tom.
And at the time,
I remember thinking, and I hadn't listened to the record in a few years, and I was thinking, oh, that's great. Let's do that. I know all those tunes. I'm cool with that. And then I started listening to it and realizing, oh, my goodness, there's all this strings and all this orchestration and all this stuff. So I had to assemble, two violas, two violins, cello, a bass player who could also play arco, you know, guitar.
Wow, so you recreated the whole thing.
The whole thing. Two flutes. Actually, on the original recording, there are four flutes, but I did it with two because I realized—
Where did you do this? Where did you perform
it? A place called Fulton Market. Fulton Street Collective is the name of it.
Wow.
Chris Anderson runs this place, and it's great. And you can go in and do if you pick a record, you can do it. And some people have picked some really, you know, amazing, like a guy did Herbie Hancock's The Prisoner. Jeff Bradfield did that, and it was really amazing. You know, I mean, so people have done a lot of great things. But I did this. I had a conductor, and we did the whole thing. And then we ended up doing it at the Jazz Festival in 2018. So it ended up having a very good result, and everybody was super happy about it. I remember when I heard that years and years ago, you know, I remember thinking, that has got everything about bossa nova that's really cool in 1 minute and 41 seconds. It's got a cool beginning, it's got a cool ending, everything that happens in between. There's these little things that Cesar's playing piano, and he plays such cool little, you know, interior motivic things that are just absolutely iconic.
Chegou, sorriu, venceu, depois chorou, então fui eu quem consolou sua
tristeza, na certeza de que o amor tem dessas fases mais.
I'm Judy Carmichael, and this is Jazz Inspired. I'm talking with pianist-composer Steve Million. Misery Waltz. Talk about this track.
Yeah, that one's really actually very special to me. Now, that tune, you probably don't, I don't know if you know the Misery Waltz.
There's yes, of course. I get around.
Da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da, right? Harry Truman used to famously play that on the piano, I'm told. But yes, so my mom used to play that tune, and I remember growing up sort of hearing it, you know, sometimes, because I'm from Missouri. And years later, I wrote what I called the Misery Waltz, and I recorded it on my second record, I think, with Palmetto back in the 90s. With Chris Potter, Randy Brecker, you know, big Michael Moore on bass. Yeah, and, you know, we did it too fast. I remember thinking, I didn't like the take, and it was in the key of F, and I sort of shelved it after that. I just didn't want to play. I just remember thinking that I didn't know what I was doing with that tune particularly. It was my least favorite on that record. I remember thinking that. But then years later, I sort of got it back out and started playing it slower and more gospelitized it. And then I started getting together with Sarah, and I just thought, this is a perfect tune to write lyrics. Now, what am I going to write? And I realized that this tune actually had lyrics that were residing in my head all that time. So they just kind of flowed out of me. It was amazing. That was probably one of those tunes where I just sat down and in one session wrote those whole lyrics. I didn't have to think about it. Or, you know, a lot of times I've worked on lyrics for a long, long time trying to get, you know, to something, you know, but that one just kind of came right out. And it, you know, it's about, you know, feeling, I think, you know, if you grew up in a small town, like I did, a little claustrophobic, a little bit like, I think there's a line in there. I think I say, we've got so much more to do before we leave here. You know, and I compare living there as like sort of being in a prison, which I'm sure that some of my friends who still live there would resent me saying that. But it's just that, you know, when I was a kid, I did have that, you know, I think I was a budding musician who really needed a scene. It's about trying to escape, you know, the bounds, the boundaries of the small town vibe.
Really a mystery. Help me.
Steve, we did it.
Judy, thank you.
I'm so excited that we did this. I see you there in your studio. You've got a vest on. Is it cold in Chicago right now?
You know, I wear this thing. It gets...
Oh, that's okay. No, it looks great. It's very fashionable. But I'm usually, you often get the weather first before it comes here. I'll check in with my Chicago friends and they'll tell me what's happening.
It's going to be...
And then it hits me in New York. So, because it's warm here.
Today is like, I'm looking at my weather. Well, it's almost 50 degrees out.
That's what it is here. Yeah. So it's warm. So this was just a style choice on your part, but I like it. But thank you so much. Love the CD.
You.
Thank you for taking the time. And I look forward to meeting you in person when I next get to Chicago.
All right.
Thank you so much. You've been listening to my conversation with Steve Million. I hope you'll join me here next time when I talk with another creative person about how jazz inspires their life and work. I'm Judy Carmichael, the host and producer of Jazz Inspired. My production engineer is Curtis Heidolf. You can listen to Judy Carmichael's Jazz Inspired on all podcast platforms and at jazzinspired.com. Our opening music was Airmail Special, and the mid-break music is a smooth one from my CD, High on Fats and Other Stuff. The closing music is Old Fashioned Love from my CD Trio. I'm on piano with Mike Hashem on sax and Chris Flory on guitar. Judy Carmichael's Jazz Inspired is sponsored in part with generous support from our listeners and Paige at 63 Main in Sag Harbor, New York, serving organic microgreens and vegetables grown on their own energy-efficient indoor and outdoor aquaponic farms. Better taste, happier planet. Visit Paige at 63 Main at opentable.com. And please tell your friends about Jazz Inspired and help us spread the word. For more information, visit jazzinspired.com or judycarmichael.com.